Welcome to our continuing educational webinar series. I'm Catherine Short, Manager of Virtual Education for First Healthcare Compliance. At First Healthcare Compliance, we help you with a comprehensive compliance management solution tailored to your business. A hospital, hospital network, healthcare practice of any size, billing company, or skilled nursing facility, and we help manage every aspect of a compliance program, and our training library provides hundreds of modules that are easy to assign and track. As part of our complimentary educational webinar series, we bring you experts from around the country to discuss relevant topics in the healthcare industry. We are so pleased to have Lauren Moak Russell, counsel at Young Conway Stargat and Taylor LLP in Wilmington, Delaware, with us today. Lauren specializes in the representation of employers on a range of issues related to compliance with local, state, and federal labor and employment laws and constitutional provisions. She provides compassionate and responsive counsel targeted at achieving client goals while minimizing cost and risk. Lauren emphasizes client counseling on issues ranging from wage and hour compliance to workplace training and investigations to effective employee terminations with the goal of avoiding litigation before it begins. Her counseling practice includes handbook revisions, effective policy implementation, and on-site training on legal compliance. Lauren has developed and conducts specialized in-house training for emerging legal issues, including the pregnancy, reproductive rights, and family care provisions for the Delaware Discrimination in Employment Act. One of her current programs outlines the complexities of the Me Too movement and offers executives essential information on harassment avoidance and modifying corporate culture. Lauren also conducts high-level investigations of discrimination and harassment on behalf of employers. Before we begin, I would like to mention at First Healthcare Compliance, we strive to serve as a trusted resource for compliance professionals, and every month we celebrate their hard work and dedication with our Compliance Super Ninja recognition. Our team is turning today to the spotlight on Super Ninja Sharon Miller, Administrator at Gulf Coast Dermatology Laboratories, and Sharon says patient care is paramount, and by creating a culture of caring, compassion, and respect, we have succeeded in all we do. We try to promote a family atmosphere, which in turn translates to ultimate patient care. Thank you, Sharon. Congratulations. Our team is honored to have the privilege of working with you. A copy of the slides is available for download on the control panel. Feel free to submit questions into the question box on your control panel during the presentation. We will address questions at the conclusion. Will come directly from Paycom, and your PMI certificate will come from our email. There's no need to request either one. Additional CU opportunities will be available to BC Advantage members following the live broadcast. See their website for details. Lauren, I'm so very happy to welcome you back here today. It's a true pleasure. I love working with you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
So I'm going to dig right in. And today we're focusing on a topic that a lot of businesses don't spend much time thinking about. And we're really focused today on non-unionized workforces. There are many, many aspects of the healthcare field that are heavily unionized, particularly hospitals. But the provisions of federal labor law really impact almost every business in the country when we're talking about the private sector. And so that's what we're going to focus on today. First and foremost, in terms of topics that we are going to cover, we're going to focus on just what is the National Labor Relations Act and how does it apply to non-unionized workplaces? This is an issue that I think really surprises a lot of my clients and something that they don't spend much time thinking about. And then I want to talk about current NLRB enforcement priorities. So the National Labor Relations Board is the administrative entity that is tasked with enforcing the National Labor Relations Act. And the board changes probably more than any other federal administrative agency from Republican to Democratic administrations. Needless to say, from the Obama administration to the Trump administration, and then from the Trump administration to the Biden administration, we have seen some really wild swings in terms of the enforcement priorities and the general conduct of the board. And we're going to talk about that a little bit and why that's happened. And then what that means for you, for a non-unionized business, and the way that you should be, or the lens perhaps through which you should be viewing the types of issues that we're going to talk about today. So let's start by talking about the National Labor Relations Board. The board has statutory jurisdiction under the National Labor Relations Act over private sector employers who are active in interstate commerce and exceed a minimum threshold of financial sort of business, right? So at the low end, and this depends on the sector of the economy you're in, on the low end, it can be as small as $50,000, on the high end, as much as $1 million, but virtually every business is engaged in interstate commerce, right? I work for a law firm that is in Wilmington, and so we could say, well, you know, we are a Delaware law firm. We don't act in interstate commerce. We work with the Delaware courts. Well, that's not entirely true, because there are California and Nevada and Arizona and Massachusetts companies that enter contracts that with Delaware choice of law provisions. So there are companies, businesses from all over the country that come here to do business and then come here to litigate cases. And so we are accepting money from all over the country. There are some classic Supreme Court cases that sort of say, well, if you're a small barbecue joint in South Carolina, but you get the wood for your barbecues from North Carolina, that's interstate commerce, right? And so in today's globalized society, it is virtually impossible to say, oh gosh, no, I am truly a local business. I do not operate in any manner in interstate commerce. So generally speaking, when we are talking about who is subject to the National Labor Relations Act, you should assume that your business is operating in interstate commerce, even if you are a small medical practice that you know only serves the metropolitan Atlanta region, for example, right? I'm just in Georgia, that's all I do. You probably get supplies from outside of Georgia. And you probably treat patients from outside of Georgia, at least on occasion, especially if you're a specialist or you're particularly good at what you do, people may come in to see you, right? So we should start from the position of always assuming that every business is operating in interstate commerce. And then we look at the, you know, at your volume, your sort of revenue. And again, I would start from the position of assuming that you're in that $50,000 threshold, which is a very easy threshold to meet for a successful and thriving business. So assuming that you are operating in interstate commerce and that you meet that $50,000 threshold, who is subject to the board's authority? This quote here is drawn directly from the board's current website. And it says, as a practical matter, the board's jurisdiction is very broad and covers the great majority of non-government employers with a workplace in the United States, including nonprofits, employee-owned businesses, labor organizations, non-union businesses, and businesses in states with quote right-to-work laws. So the board, we start from the premise that the board thinks that it has authority over virtually everyone. And if the board believes that it has authority over virtually everyone, they will exercise that authority. There are a couple of exceptions. The National Labor Relations Act does not govern federal, state, or local governments, Federal Reserve banks, government corporations. Here in Delaware, if you are operating in the public sector, you're subject to the authority of the Delaware Public Employment Relations Board. And that does govern some state-run hospitals. And likewise, the vast majority of states have their own sort of you know, sort of union oversight authority. Usually it's called something like a public employment relations board or public employment relations commission. In New Jersey, it's the PERC. They are responsible if you are a medical practice that is unionized in the public sector. So a state-run hospital, again, for example, then you might be subject to that authority. But otherwise, if you are not a publicly operated organization, then you are almost certainly subject to the National Labor Relations Act. Again, it does not matter whether you are whether you're a unionized or a non-unionized facility. We are still going to be subject there. There are some other exceptions that are less applicable to the medical field. Employers who operate only with agricultural laborers, farming operations, cultivating and harvest, preparing commodities for delivery, and then interstate travel organizations. So if your business were to be subject to the Railway Labor Act, which covers railroads and airlines. But again, I don't expect that those are exemptions that are going to apply in the medical field. So how does the National Labor Relations Board, which by its name governs labor relations, right, unionized facilities, how does it purport to exercise authority over non-unionized workforces? Well, here's your answer. Section 7 of the National Labor Relations Act is sort of the this is the heart of the act. This is what it does, right? It provides employees with the right to engage in concerted activities for the purpose of collective bargaining or other mutual aid or protection, right? So this says, certainly if I am a union shop steward and I'm speaking up and saying, you should give my union members more money, that is protected concerted activity. But it is not just conduct in aid of collective bargaining. It's also anything else that would lead to mutual aid or protection. So my boss always said when I was starting out in this practice, if you stand by yourself in a corner and complain, I can fire you. If you're complaining to a coworker, I can't, because that is mutual aid or protection, right? So when I am saying I'm underpaid, that's something that you can terminate me for if you don't like to listen to my complaints. But when I say to one of my coworkers, we are underpaid, we should be getting more, that is for mutual aid. We are working together to assist one another in raising up, the quality of our terms and conditions of employment. When employees complain, for example, in today's day and age, about things like the right to work remotely, when they complain about COVID protocols, you're not doing enough to protect us from the spread of disease, for example. When they complain about work hours, it's not, we're working too many hours. It's not fair that we should have to stay until 6 o'clock every night to transcribe records or to finish all of the insurance billing, or take your pick of things that employees complain about, right? Anytime that they are getting together to complain about the terms and conditions of their employment, they may be acting for mutual aid or protection. Similarly, when somebody says, it's not fair, you shouldn't discipline us for coming in late because we are all struggling under the burden of, again, take your pick, right? We're all, dealing with the added stresses of trying to manage a household in the pandemic, or, newly post-pandemic, and as we're coming out and trying to figure out what this is like. All of that conduct, any of those complaints, can be for mutual aid or protection. The issue comes up, of course, when not so much when you hear the complaints and choose not to do anything about it. That is the employer's right, right? The employer is not compelled to do anything in response to these employee complaints, but we cannot discipline or retaliate against employees because, as you see under Section 7, they have the right to engage in concerted activity for mutual aid or protection, right? That is the key. And when we punish them for exercising the right, we run up against the National Labor Relations Act Section 7 protections. You'll see in that last bullet point, there is no requirement that a workplace be unionized for an employee to exercise these Section 7 rights. So what happens if we bump up against this, right? Section 8A defines one type of unfair labor practice. It says that it shall be an unfair labor practice for an employer to interfere with, restrain, or coerce employees in the exercise of their Section 7 rights, right? So when employees get together and complain, you don't have to do anything, right? Ignoring them is not interference. But when you tell them that they are no longer allowed to talk about wages, right? That was a very popular prohibition at one time in this country, and a lot of huge national employers had standard policies that said employees may not discuss their compensation. And the intent was certainly not to interfere with Section 7 rights, but the thought was, well, when employees compare their income, it leads to resentment and, unhealthy gossipy dynamics. So businesses said, you shouldn't do that. That's naughty behavior. That is a restraint of concerted activity, right? To have that policy that says you may not do that. And so those types of policies are what we would consider to be unfair labor practices. So when there is an unfair labor practice, this is the remainder of this section, an individual has the right to bring a charge before the National Labor Relations Board. There is a 6-month statutory deadline to file an unfair labor practices charge. And this is very much like other types of administrative charges, including, for example, a charge of discrimination that might be filed with the EEOC. Those types of charges, many more employers, are comfortable with, they understand, they've seen them before. Very few non-unionized employers have seen an unfair labor practices charge before the National Labor Relations Board, but it's very similar. You get a sheet of paper in the mail, and it comes with a letter from a board agent, which is sort of like your assigned investigator. And they say, well, we want information on the following things, and we would like to interview the following witnesses. And you have to prepare a position statement and defend in the exact same way that you do a charge of discrimination, if your business has ever seen one of those. And I will tell you, if you thought the deck was stacked against you in front of other administrative agencies, the National Labor Relations Board is its own particular treat, and is, can be very aggressive in the enforcement of these rights. So it's really something that non-unionized employers need to be aware of, because when a board agent comes calling, you really need to be ready to respond and defend. This pattern of enforcement action against non-unionized workforces has been evolving over sort of the last, oh goodness, certainly more than a decade now. And this is a piece of that puzzle, right? So the Bureau of Labor Statistics, which is a federal agency, tracks the unionization rates in the United States. And as you can see, we have had a very steady downward trend since the early 1980s, from about 20% of the workforce being unionized to about 10% as of the last report in 2021. You see, we're actually at pretty much the same rate we were at 2019. There looks like there was a jump in 2020, right? And that's because there were mass layoffs due to the pandemic, as everybody was aware. But these layoffs significantly impacted non-unionized workforces over unionized workforces. I think there are a couple of reasons for this, and I don't think that it necessarily has to do with the power of labor unions in the country. It largely has to do with the most essential things that were happening, right? So we had aspects of manufacturing, food production, and healthcare that were still really going strong during the pandemic to ensure that people could get medical treatment at hospitals and that they could eat and get absolute essentials. And those workforces, food production and healthcare and manufacturing, are heavily unionized, right? So, you know, I think it shows more that the most essential aspects of our economy tend to be more heavily unionized than anything else. But just an interesting blip for any of you who may have noticed that jump and wondered why that was. Everything about the pandemic was unique, and labor relations was not immune. So in the face of declining unionization over the past, oh goodness, now what is coming up 40 years, I, like many other folks, still sort of think, oh, it's just around 2000. It's very hard for me to believe that we are 20 years in to the millennia. In light of this 40-year trend, what is the board to do, right? Does it resign itself to obsolescence? No, of course it doesn't. It looks at the National Labor Relations Act and thinks, how can we continue to protect societally important rights when we are looking at these greatly decreased rates? And so, you know, the goal is to enforce the National Labor Relations Act to the greatest extent possible within non-unionized workforces. And the hammer that is going to accomplish this feat under the Biden administration is National Labor Relations Board General Counsel Jennifer Abruzzo. President Biden made no secret of his intent to enforce the National Labor Relations Act aggressively, and said very publicly that he wanted to be the most labor-friendly president that the country had ever had. And Jennifer Abruzzo lives and breathes that goal. She has expressed her areas of focus in a series of written documents, including general counsel memos that we're going to talk about, and also some written briefing in cases pending before the National Labor Relations Board and federal courts across the country. So what is she seeking to accomplish? And I want to talk about some of her goals, and then we'll talk about how does this really impact the non-unionized employer. So she wants to reverse the NLRB's precedent in American Federation for Children, which held that an employee's expressed concerns were not protected concerted activity because other employees did not join in the activities and some employees were offended by them. So this is sort of the protection of the unpopular opinion. And if you have an unpopular opinion, for example, about masking and vaccination, are you still engaged in protected concerted activity? And do you have to be able to point to a collection of people and say, I'm speaking for them or with them? You'll remember a little bit earlier in the presentation, I said, if you're complaining by yourself in a corner, I can fire you. But if you're complaining to a coworker, I can't. She wants to change that traditional standard. And this has been the law, really in large part for a very long time. GC Abruzzo really wants to empower the American labor force in a way that they have not historically been empowered. And I will tell you, this is the labor market to do it in, right? Employees have a very strong position right now, and she wants to help them exercise that. Okay, what else does she want to do? So she has issued GC Memo 2104. The GC stands for General Counsel. So this is a memo issued by her office talking about their priorities. The 21 reflects the year in which it was issued, 2021, and 04 is the number, right? So you look at the year of issuance, and then they sort of get consecutive numbers at the end. So GC Memo 2104 targets policies and procedures that employers may have. This is a handbook focus, right? So handbook policies and procedures, or SOPs, any of those types of sort of non-contractual documents that businesses generate to tell employees how the business operates, may be unlawful on their face if a cautious employee could interpret them to interfere with Section 7 rights to engage in protected concerted activity. And the board is focused on a series of issues, right? And those are listed in this third bullet point. Confidentiality provisions, non-disparagement agreements, social media policies, media communication policies, civility and respectful workplace and professionalism policies, offensive language, and no cameras at work rules. This is a sweeping focus, right? So let's talk about how these things sort of play out. If there is a confidentiality policy and I say, well, you know, our wages aren't fair, or our wages at this company are not consistent with industry standard, the company says, well, you breached our confidentiality agreement that prohibits you talking about any aspect of our business operations. Well, that would discourage me from exercising my Section 7 rights, right? Non-disparagement policies. Companies often feel disparaged when employees criticize them publicly. And this goes to the social media and media communications policies too, right? So if I go on social media and I say, my company XYZ is the worst. They forced me to work in unsafe conditions. They never offered me hazard pay during the pandemic. And you know, they take us for granted and I'm sick and tired of it. That violates a lot of company non-disparagement and social media policies. And then here in Delaware, the lead newspaper is the News Journal. So the Delaware News Journal called me and said, Lauren Russell, we saw your post about company XYZ, and we would love to talk to you about that. If my company says that employees are not permitted to talk to the media about company business, that would again discourage me from speaking out on behalf of myself and my coworkers. It would, to a cautious employee, appear to interfere with my engagement in protected concerted activity. In the same way, civility and respectful and professional communications policies sort of say, well, you need to treat your coworkers with respect and courtesy in the workplace. Well, when I get angry that I'm underpaid or that I'm being forced to work in an environment that I don't think is safe, or that I should be permitted to continue remote work because, gosh, the pandemic is still ongoing, I may think that I am being perfectly civil. But generally, when we're talking about contentious issues like this, management's idea of what is respectful and employees' idea of what is respectful don't align completely. And again, a cautious employee might feel discouraged. No cameras at work. If there is a speech being given at a plant and management says, you know, we're going to do this or we're going to do that, or you shouldn't be talking about contentious issues here, no more discussions about Black Lives Matter or police brutality or, take your pick. Any contentious workplace issue. We won't tolerate any more discussion about our vaccine mandate or our masking requirement. It's here to stay. Stop complaining, right? If I have my camera out and I'm recording this, many, many businesses have no camera at work rules. I may be violating my company's policies, but I'm doing it in an effort to preserve information and perhaps work with my coworkers to say, hey, we should be allowed to talk about these things, or, you know, they can't stop us from pushing back about vaccination or masking, or again, take your pick of any contentious issue these days. And maybe I get a little excited and I curse in the process of standing up for myself on one of these issues, right? All of these types of policies are things that can cool employee communication and can run up against Section 7 rights. And GC Abruzzo is looking very carefully at them and thinking, gosh, this is, you know, a way that the National Labor Relations Board can really make itself very relevant in the current world. In addition, Memo 2104 looks to reverse past authority from the board, particularly the Trump National Labor Relations Board, prohibiting employers from requiring employees to keep internal investigations confidential. This is a very contentious issue, and most employer side labor attorneys, myself included, think that, you know, the board tends to be a little bit more critical of employers than employees in this situation. When we talk about internal investigations, employers' counsel always want complete confidentiality. Why? Because it protects the company from retaliation claims. If I am in the process of a harassment or a discrimination investigation, it is my general practice to tell all of the parties involved, you may not discuss this with anyone else, because we are trying to conduct a clean, unbiased investigation. And if you talk to other witnesses and tell them what you said, it can alter their testimony. And in addition, the farther this information spreads, the greater the chance that there will be some retaliation by someone against the person who came forward with the complaint. The National Labor Relations Board, many of us think, tends to take the position that, gosh, only employers can retaliate. And so if you keep things quiet, that allows employers to do sneaky, underhanded things. And so it's really sort of a conflict of view and of goal when we talk about these confidentiality provisions. But be very aware that that this is an issue that the federal government is questioning right now. In addition, she wants to reverse authority regarding whether or not employers can put confidentiality and non-disparagement clauses in settlement agreements or prohibit employees from initiating civil enforcement actions. So what does this mean in practice? Almost every severance agreement that you will ever see includes confidentiality and mutual non-disparagement provisions. And it says that an employee releases all of his or her rights to file civil lawsuits. Every settlement agreement should always carve out the right to file a civil enforcement action before the SEC, the NLRB, the EEOC, and similarly tasked federal enforcement agencies. This has been the case as long as I have been in practice. So at least, 13 to 15 years. This is a very, very old expectation. But if you are working with, first of all, if you download a severance agreement off the internet, it might not, have appropriate carve outs to allow somebody to break confidentiality and non-disparagement to file these complaints. Or if you're working with an attorney who's not really a specialist in labor and employment law, they might not know that these carve outs are extremely important. And the National Labor Relations Board has taken the position that if you include an overbroad release or overbroad confidentiality provisions, that it's just going to completely ignore the settlement agreement and it is not going to enforce them and it will undertake its own investigation and consequences be darned. Okay. So what does this mean, practically speaking, for non-unionized businesses? First and foremost, we need to take a look at policies and procedures and think about how we are going to tackle them. First, general stability provisions are out. It is risky, to say the least, to say something like, employees must be courteous and respectful at all times. And, the issue with those kinds of policies is that, again, a manager's definition of what is courteous and respectful is very different than an employee's definition of what is courteous and respectful. It can chill discourse. It can make employees afraid to come forward. And I will tell you, I have had many a manager come to me and say, well, they insulted our policies. That was uncivil. But it wasn't, was it? You know, if somebody says to you respectfully, you know, I really feel taken advantage of, and I don't think this is fair, and I'm very frustrated with the situation. That's not discourteous. It's not uncivil, as far as I am concerned. It's certainly not uncivil as far as GC Abruzzo is concerned. And so those kinds of policies, particularly where they come with a broader corporate culture that senior leadership should not be challenged or questioned, are going to lead to the risk of an unfair labor practices charge. What can you say, right? All of the things below this second dash are all permissible policies. You can prohibit knowingly false communications. You can absolutely prohibit harassment, discrimination, and retaliation. Those are unlawful activities that an employer is obligated to address in the workplace. Now, when we're talking about harassment, discrimination, and retaliation, that is conduct on the basis of your membership in a protected category. So racial harassment, sexual harassment, age or disability-based harassment, and there are quite a few other protected categories here in the state of Delaware. We have greatly expanded the protections beyond those that are recognized under federal law. But setting that aside, we're talking here about unlawful conduct. We are not talking about bullying. This is not, oh, I feel harassed because I'm being criticized for the quality of my work. That is not unlawful harassment. And you know, when we create these policies, we need to be really clear that they are targeted at the elimination of illegal conduct, not at workplace civility. We can prohibit unlawful conduct, physical threats or acts of violence. Any of that is, including, by the way, implicit threats. You know, if you do that again, you'd better beware. You don't know, you don't want to know what I'm going to do to you if you ever do that again. Right? Those are sort of implicit threats. There is clearly an expectation that something negative is going to happen, and that kind of behavior is inappropriate. Any threat of workplace violence or aggression is outside the bounds of the protections of the National Labor Relations Act. Offensive language prohibition should be really targeted at things that are objectively offensive to everyone. Racially and sexually harassing language, language that targets any individual on the basis of a protected category. So disability-based language, the R word, for example, racial slurs, easy. Age-based bias, you're too old to get this, you know, those kinds of things. Religious-based bias, one that I haven't mentioned yet. That kind of behavior, again, falls within the realm of harassment and discrimination and is very easy to prohibit. But be careful that we're not prohibiting what was traditionally called shop talk. Shop talk is rough language that is really focused on improving the nature of our collective work environment. So if I were to say, I'm just so damn angry about the way that I'm being, you know, treated at this company, you know, might that be unprofessional? Certainly it is. Cursing in the workplace is oftentimes considered unprofessional or unacceptable. But it's really not about the cursing. It's really about the concerted activity. That's the focus of that comment. And when we're talking about disciplining people, employees, for saying things that upset management, we need to look very critically at the behavior of other people. So I talked to a client recently. They were having a very contentious internal debate about remote work options. And in the course of that conversation, somebody cursed, said you know, a curse word to the, it's sort of mumbling to themselves, you know, this is BS, you know, is essentially what was said. But they didn't abbreviate. And so the client came to me and said, well, we want to discipline that person for cursing. I said, has anybody else ever cursed in this business? Well, the answer was yes, right? If you allow cursing in the workplace, but you only discipline it when you don't like the message that it's coming with, that's going to create legal liability. Similarly, when employees at, let's say, a weekly luncheon are talking about, you know, divisive issues and start getting angry, we want to discipline them for insubordination. Okay. Did they disobey a directive? Well, no, we didn't tell them to do anything in particular. Well, it's not insubordination, right? It is not insubordinate to dislike your manager's policy as much as many managers would like it to be so. And so we really have to look critically at the question of, do we not like the behavior or do we not like the message? And when we have tolerated similar behavior because it was related to a better message, then you're going to have real issues and you need to be very careful because we're straying into the shop talk territory, right? I don't like your attitude or your tone, but it's really because I don't like what you're talking about. All right, what else should we be thinking about? We need to be thinking about internal investigations within an organization. In order to justify confidentiality requirements tied to internal investigations under the sort of standards that are being articulated by the current National Labor Relations Board, by the General Counsel, I should clarify, we really need to, need to establish that there is a credible concern of retaliation. And so we should, and let me tell you, I have never conducted an internal investigation where employees were not legitimately concerned about retaliation. That is the number one reason that employees do not come forward with internal complaints. So for the National Labor Relations Board to say, oh, that's just a cover for employer secrecy, is a ridiculous position. I have interviewed dozens and dozens of people over the course of my career in horrific internal investigations. And many times, many of these individuals have suffered in silence because they were worried that they were going to lose their jobs if they spoke up. And so for that to be cast aside as an employer excuse, I think is highly questionable. So this should not be a heavy lift for employers, right? I generally like to sort of create a summary sheet at the beginning of an investigation. Here is the allegation that we received. Here is the scope of what we are going to investigate. Because keep in mind, many times allegations of misconduct come forward and it's the kitchen sink, right? Well, my manager did this thing, and I got the bad review, and I only got a 2% raise instead of a 3% raise. And one time I mentioned my kitten, and my manager said that he hates cats. And also, this one time, my manager brushed against my buttocks. And you're like, 99% of that is crap. But if your manager brushed against your behind, that is a very serious allegation, and we're going to investigate that. So we start with, you know, here is the scope of the allegation. Here is what we are actually going to investigate. We're not gonna worry about the fact that he hates cats. That's an interpersonal conflict. It might not have been a nice thing to say, but it's not illegal. But certainly unwanted sexual contact, big problem. So we define the scope, and then we look at what is the reasoning for our need for confidentiality here? And in these situations, very often you start with one complaint and then it becomes a cascade. You have somebody perhaps in a very powerful position who could terminate the complainant or make his or her life very difficult. in the interim. And certainly if the complainant comes forward and says, I am scared of retaliation, right? These are all points that we can use to say, we're doing everything we can to prevent retaliation. But retaliation is not just about the complainant getting fired. It's also about his or her life being made uncomfortable because he or she is afraid, or because they're getting bad work assignments, or the manager refuses to interact with them anymore. All of those things can create an intimidating and hostile and retaliatory environment. So we want to lay out what we can in terms of a basis for the protection. If there is no credible fear of retaliation, confidentiality is still important. And so we can do other things. We can encourage confidentiality. We can explain an employee's rights that, you know, we're not going to require you to keep this confidential, but we think everybody is going to be more comfortable if we, you know, are able to maintain confidentiality in this situation. I'll tell you, most people who come forward with complaints of harassment and discrimination are worried that they'll be viewed as complainers, as whiners. And so they are very sensitive about it getting out, that they are the originating witness, and they don't want it to be, you know, out in the public. You address the concerns about workplace gossip and the damage that it can do. And really make sure that employees feel agency and involvement. I will tell you that when I do interviews where I don't feel like I've got a great basis to demand confidentiality, I'll say, you know, I really think that it's for the best if this stays confidential. And virtually every employee down to the man or woman will say, of course, I would never share this. This is much too sensitive. So employees, you know, feel more in control and less like they're being bossed around when you make it a choice for them and they can voluntarily buy in and say, yeah, you know what? Absolutely. I agree. I think that's the right thing to do too. Okay. That's really, you know, sort of what I have for the group. These are emerging and developing issues. And I can certainly tell you that GC Abruzzo's focus on non-unionized workforces is not going anywhere in the near future. And so this is something that at a bare minimum for the duration of the current administration is going to be very important and should probably be a focus in terms of employer thoughts about the way that they are operating the workforce, particularly in a highly polarized society right now. There is a lot of labor management friction going on in businesses, and we are seeing high levels of conflict when it comes to things like racial equity, when it comes to things like compensation, vaccine mandates, masking or not masking. And so those are, you know, flashpoints. And when you get an angry employee who has some understanding of his or her rights, who maybe came from a unionized workforce and knows about the National Labor Relations Board, but is now in your non-unionized workforce, this is a real risk. And it's something that you are well counseled to be aware of.
Okay. Thank you so much, Lauren. I have a few questions have come in. So the first one is, this isn't a topic that we've been talking a lot about. Why should this be back on our radars?
Yeah, so the short answer is that there's been a change in administration. The Obama administration was very focused on the expansion of the role of the National Labor Relations Board. The Trump administration had a much more conservative view of the role of the federal government and really pared back the enforcement activities that the board was engaged in. And now that we are back under a Democratic administration, that role is expanding again. You know, I happen to be somebody who thinks that Predictability is a very important thing for business. And so whether you are going to have an expansive view or a retractive view of the board's role, and there are grounds to argue for both, right? It's not that one side is patently wrong and the other is patently right. It's really a matter of philosophy. Whatever the case may be, it is good for businesses to know what the expectations of them are. And the National Labor Relations Board swings much more broadly than really any other federal enforcement agency. And that's a tough thing for employers to cope with. You'll see in those slides, we talked about the fact that GC Abruzzo is looking to directly overturn precedent from the Trump administration that is really only a couple of years old. This is not... conversely, the Trump administration looked to overturn principles that in some cases were decades old. And so this is really a problem for both sides of the aisle. I don't think that anybody is conducting themselves necessarily in the way that provides the most predictability for business. And so the best we can do here on the outside is to make sure that employers are educated and know that these risks are out there. And I'm certainly talking about it a lot more because I am seeing, and I was in practice under the Obama administration, the Trump administration, and now under the Biden administration, I have never seen as much effort to enforce against the private sector as I am seeing now. So Biden has held true to his promise to be the most labor-friendly president that many of us will see in our lifetimes. And so despite the fact that the Obama administration expressed an interest in pursuing these matters, we're seeing the enforcement drive from the Biden administration that perhaps was not quite so present before.
Okay, so it sounds like there's a lot of reason to be concerned, but I know that I know this from talking to a lot of our administrators, like hospital administrators, practice administrators, all kinds of, CEOs and CFOs, et cetera, that they have a lot on their plates right now and so much to be concerned about. So it feels kind of like probably for some that this is just another thing that they need to be worried about, right? If you could give one piece of advice to businesses, and if they could only do one thing, what should it be?
I would take a really careful look at handbooks. That is an area that almost every business I represent neglects because, you know, it's there and, you know, it's this other thing is an emergency and I've got to put out that fire. And to your point, everybody has a tremendous amount of work on their plates right now. This is the most difficult environment to operate in that I've ever seen. It is truly amazing that people are able to get up and soldier on every morning. And that's from the management side and from the labor side. You know, everybody's got a lot on their plates. So if we could move the handbook to the top of your non-emergency stack, that's what I would do. Handbooks should really get a thorough going over every couple of years anyway. And so if you haven't taken a careful look at your handbook in the last 2 years to update it and make sure that it's compliant with your current labor and employment laws, that's a great thing to do. And take a look at those things, workplace civility, social media, and make sure that you're really focused on illegal behavior and not just, employees shouldn't say things that make us unhappy. Right? Any policy that's designed to keep employees from saying embarrassing things in public is going to likely be a problem. We should really be focused on do not engage in illegal behavior. If you are on Facebook with a picture of you and your favorite marijuana paraphernalia, that's something we can prohibit. We can prohibit harassment and discrimination and defamation. Defamation is illegal behavior, right? That is, it's a tort. It is unlawful. You can prohibit defamatory conduct. But when we're talking about general civility and be nice and be courteous, that's a tough thing to enforce.
Okay. Well, I wanted to thank you so much, Lauren. Did you have any other words of advice that you wanted to leave us with today?
tolerance, kindness, right? I will tell you that you run into union problems when both sides of the equation, management and employees, are not able to take a deep breath and say, hey, I really need you to hear me, but I could have said that nicer, right? And I think that, and I keep seeing these news headlines about how mean people are right now, that people are just, they've hit their limits and they are mean. And I hear that anecdotally from clients too. And I think we've got to take a deep breath and be a little less mean. When there is a sense of respect and dignity between labor and management, you really avoid the vast majority of these issues. So kindness.
Great, great. That's always wonderful advice. So I wanted to thank you so much for being here today and for offering us this presentation. We have not had a presentation like this previously, so I really appreciate that. So thank you so much, and especially during this time and this change of administration. So thank you.
Very happy to be here. Thank you for the opportunity.
Yes, and attendees, please use the contact information that will be available, and we will make Lauren's contact information available for any questions. And if you send us any questions, we'll forward them on to Lauren as well. Please remember your Paycom and PMI CEU certificate will be emailed to you from within 2 days following the broadcast. There's no need to request it. You can register for future webinars or request a demo of our compliance solution on our website at firsthcc.com or call us at 888-543-4778. And thank you for joining us.